Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the Ukraine. We'll talk both about Russian President Putin's role in supporting the alleged winner of the election and the extent to which there's a division between East and West, both in the Ukraine and in terms of U.S.-Russian relations, given that the United States is backing the opposition candidate, Yushchenko, who appears to have won, at least given the cloud of fraud and doubt about the election. We'll be talking with Andrew Jack, who's the outgoing correspondent for the Financial Times of London in Moscow. He's the author of Inside Putin's Russia, Can There Be Reform Without Democracy? We'll be talking to him in a moment about Putin's role in both the Ukrainian election and his relationship with George Bush. And we'll also be talking with Dr. Jim Walsh, who's an international security expert at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. We're talking to Dr. Walsh about the strategic implications of a divided Ukraine, how much the eastern border of NATO can push up against Russia and the former Soviet Union, and also the proliferation issues involved in the Ukraine. And then we'll talk with Robert Young Pelton, who is the author of a couple of bestsellers, The World's Most Dangerous Places and Three Worlds Gone Mad. And Robert Young Pelton is, as we speak, in the world's most dangerous place. That is, he is riding along with the Blackwater contractors in Baghdad. These are the contractors, several of whom, four of whom were killed and strung up in Fallujah that led to the first Marine incursion into Fallujah some months back. He's with these Blackwater contractors doing what they call the BIAP run, the Baghdad International Airport, into the Green Zone. It's a seven-mile run, the most dangerous place in the world. And on the first trip he took, he told me they were attacked 16 times. So hopefully we'll get through. He's trying to get through to us by satellite phone. So it's not entirely sure that we'll get to Robert Young Pelton, but we'll try. I'm now speaking with Andrew Jack, who is the author, as I mentioned, of Inside Putin's Russia, Can There Be Reform Without Democracy? And Andrew Jack is the outgoing bureau chief of the Financial Times of London in Moscow. And he's been covering Russia since 1998. And also Dr. Jim Walsh is joining us as well. Let me begin with you, Andrew Jack. Some time back, President Bush looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. Every time I see him on television, I see a secret policeman. So what's your reading? Is this a soulmate or a secret policeman?
Well, I think he's certainly a secret policeman, and of course one of the main roles of the KGB as it existed in the past in Soviet times was precisely to get to know your enemy and to charm them and to be able to use them. And I think we've seen over the years, both in Russia's internal policies, but particularly in its foreign relations under President Putin, very adept use of those skills. And of course, Ukraine at the moment has been the most flagrant recent example of Putin playing essentially a foreign policy card in order to at least restore and reinforce the former Soviet part of the empire that existed around Russia.
But how naive are we not to see the writing on the wall here? If Putin is behind these flagrant elections, these flagrantly fraudulent elections, where the state-controlled media, which of course we know that Putin has corralled and controlled the Russian media now, where you know the previous oligarchs who were opposed to him have been purged, and now the media is all on side. And it's because of the fact that the media was completely in the old Soviet style that they were able to brainwash at least half of the electorate in the Ukraine to vote for Putin's handpicked candidate. So are we naive in here in the United States and particularly in the White House to think that you got to? It's not what people say, but what they do that should count?
Well, I think it would be hard to say that foreign policymakers are perhaps entirely naive, but what they are, and increasingly perhaps over the last 3 or 4 years, is very much players of realpolitik. There's clearly a recognition, a growing concern to some degree, at least in private, about some of the more authoritarian trends within Russia and of Russia's influence in its near abroad, around its borders. But on the other hand, clearly, I think President Bush and many other leaders from the West also recognize that they have to develop a working relationship with Russia, as indeed they did, of course, in rather different ways during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And given the context of course, international terror, the search particularly for relatively politically stable regions that can provide oil outside of the Middle East, and a more general sense about finding partners in a pretty unstable world. And if we think about a lot of those countries that are around Russia, ranging across from China in the east, of course, through Central Asia, and touching pretty much through the Caspian into Iran and towards Iraq, I think most leaders have taken the decision that they don't want to at least enter into public confrontation with Putin. And I think to some degree, that's probably justified. What's more concerning is that perhaps there's not more private pressure, at least, taking place perhaps between diplomats and world leaders when they meet with Putin, which are maybe going a little bit too far into encouraging him to believe that he can essentially do what he likes within his own sphere of influence.
Well, so far he seems to have gotten away with quite a bit. Let me talk for a moment with and bring Dr. Jim Walsh into the conversation. He's an international security expert at the Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. And Dr. Walsh, you follow proliferation issues and security issues in the former Soviet Union. And just going back to the disintegration of the Soviet Union, there was a fairly prickly period there where there were some doubts as to whether the Ukrainians would hold on to the nuclear arsenal from the former Soviet Union. They did give them up, but there was pressure, was there not, from our side to suggest that they should hold on to them, I guess, presumably as a deterrent, not against the West, but against Russia.
Well, there were some voices, particularly in academia, that were arguing that Ukraine should hold on to its nuclear weapons. I think at the time, most government officials were working with Russia, American officials working with Russia, to try to consolidate the nuclear weapons. So they wanted Ukraine to go ahead and give them up. But the argument for Ukraine keeping them, an argument I disagreed with, but an argument nonetheless, was that there is, if you go back before the formation of the Soviet Union, some tension, some rivalry between Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine is on the edge, literally. It is that buffer zone between the West, between Europe and Russia. And so for many Ukrainians, they see themselves as the gateway to Europe. They see themselves ideologically and economically, their future being tied to Europe. On the other hand, Russians look at Ukraine, or the Russian government has looked at Ukraine, as not as a gateway, but as a buffer to keep the Germans, to keep the Europeans, to keep the West from invading Russia, as has happened so many times in the 20th century. So there is a real difference in the way the two countries view their role in the world. And with NATO expansion, now including the Balts, including all of the former Warsaw Pact, and now talk of Ukraine becoming part of the European Union, we're talking about a new world in which Russia would have Europe right on its border, cheek to jowl. And I think that's probably not an event that a lot of Russian security strategists would welcome.
And you're talking, when you say have NATO on their border, that means air bases presumably could eventually be in the Ukraine, NATO air bases? Well, I mean, they're already in Poland now, right?
So. Yeah, well, and here we're talking about not today or tomorrow, but a period of years. There was the Partnership for Peace, and now you know, joining the EU doesn't mean you're a member of NATO, but I think that's the train you get on, and the train leaves the tracks, and eventually it reaches that destination. And one would expect that the security relationship between Europe and therefore the U.S. and Ukraine would grow tighter and tighter, if, in fact, Ukraine becomes part of the European Union. I think in that way, security policy will follow economic policy. And so, not you know, that poses a problem for the Russians. Now, the Russians still have leverage over Ukraine. Ukraine depends on Russian oil. And obviously, Putin can have influence in the eastern part of Ukraine. So there's a dance that, to be done there of, you know, trying to control them without intervening directly. But I think that this is a major and important struggle in Ukraine right now, and we'll feel the effects of this one way or another several years down the line.
Let me go back to Andrew Jack in London. Andrew Jack is the author of Inside Putin's Russia, Can There Be Reform Without Democracy? And he's the outgoing Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times of London. Andrew, recently President Putin announced that the Russians have a new generation of nuclear weapons that nobody else has. What was his audience for that? Was he trying to get attention over here, or assuage his people at home who have witnessed the Great Red Army bogged down in Chechnya?
Yeah, I think the audience for that was primarily a domestic one. Putin chose to make those statements a few weeks ago in front of the annual meeting of the General Staffs, the old Russian and Soviet military hierarchies. So on the one hand, it's not surprising that he wanted to make some degree of sympathetic noises to the great Russian military might of the past, to raise morale at a time which unquestionably has suffered an awful lot from a demoralization and a reduction in the effectiveness and reach of the Russian military forces. The other thing, of course, was it came just after Putin had returned from a trip to China, where it looks as though he's effectively conceded some ground to the Chinese from a period when there was a spat in the Russian Far East over borders in the late 1960s. And also just after he'd talked about the possibility of relinquishing two of four disputed islands between Russia and Japan. So against that background of some what you might call slightly more progressive foreign policy decisions, it's perhaps no surprise that at least in terms of some of the rhetoric, he wanted to assuage that more traditional domestic group of voters and actors.
Let me again return to Dr. Jim Walsh. What's going on here in terms of how the United States gets around the sort of recalcitrant former Russian or East Bloc countries that are run by reactionaries? You know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was essentially a democratization. In fact, the former Soviet Union itself was radically democratized, and we're just talking about how it's being retrenched by Putin and by this sort of notion that KGB Incorporated has taken over Russia. We had the example of reactionaries like Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia. There's Yushchenko's, Lukashenko in Belarus, Shevardnadze in Georgia was recently overthrown by somebody apparently who's not quite as bad, and clearly the lines are drawn here again in the Ukraine between a pro-Western, more democratic leader and a more Soviet-style leader who has gotten in because of kind of thuggery and fraud. So where does what's happening in terms of what the United States is doing? You know, on the one hand, President Bush has this supposedly this good relation with Putin, but on the other hand, the Secretary Powell called this election a fraud, and presumably there are people on the ground, just like there were in Yugoslavia, helping the OTPOR, the student movement, and to some extent it seems like there's a mirror of that going on now in Kiev.
Well, I think you're right, and I think Andrew did a good job earlier sort of laying out what the competing priorities are. Within the U.S. administration, I think even from the moment President Bush took office, there were competing views within the White House about how to handle Russia. You know, and that's been true of this White House. It's been divided on foreign policy topics from how to handle Iran to how to handle North Korea. And Russia's been no different. There are people within the administration who do not trust Putin, who don't like the Russians, who don't want Russia to ever really regain any status or any power, because they fear that at some point in the future it may be a threat, and after all, it still has thousands of nuclear weapons. But those folks lost the early battles, especially once Putin and Bush met, and as you said, Bush looked into his eyes and soul, and that's one of those rare occasions, I think, where personal politics triumphed over the bureaucratic politics, that even though there are folks in the White House who didn't trust the Russians, Bush and Putin seemed to hit it off personally. And then, as Andrew pointed out, we needed the Russians. We needed their help after 9/11 to help build support for our actions in Afghanistan. Remember, Afghanistan was on the border of the old Soviet Union, and we needed the help of former Soviet republics like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan in order to base our troops and to get logistical support. So we needed the Russians. And so whether Bush liked Putin or not ended up not being very important, because the requirements of fighting the war on terrorism made Putin a necessity, a good relationship with Putin a necessity. Now, as far as democratization goes, I think the U.S. can take a stand, as it has, Secretary Powell calling into question the validity of these elections, as have international monitors. But when it comes down to it, there's not a lot of leverage the U.S. has on Russia. Andrew mentioned the near abroad and sort of dabbling in the politics of the neighboring states. Well, Russia's going to want to do that. It's going to want to protect its interests in its border area. It still feels like it's entitled to have a political weight and political say in that area. And so the question is, well, if the U.S. doesn't want that to happen, what can it do? Now, in Georgia, the U.S. has negotiated various deals to allow basing of U.S. operations there. So one answer is, the U.S. can influence what happens by putting troops on the ground in these republics. But they've got to be very careful about that. You want to pressure a country perhaps to follow a certain line, to follow democratization. But if you pressure too much, what you can get is a nationalist reaction, and then that can get very ugly. And so it's a difficult line to walk here. But the bottom line is the U.S. simply doesn't have a lot of leverage on Russia right now. We can't really threaten them with a lot because we need them in other equally important foreign policy areas.
Andrew Jack in London, the author of Inside Putin's Russia, you spent a lot of time in Moscow, and you probably were there through this period where it seems that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the ascension of Yeltsin, and the enormous influence that the United States seemed to have, to the extent that the American political operatives were running his campaigns, it seems to me that there's been a slow resurgence of anti-Americanism, that the bloom is off, if you will, and Dr. Walsh said, the United States doesn't have much leverage. It seems to me that the criticism of George W. Bush is that he hasn't exercised any leverage, that the Europeans have been putting pressure on the Russians not to turn back the clock and specifically about taking over the media and jailing and punishing the head of UCOS. Is now, of course, essentially it's being privatized. It's as though, the crony capitalism has gone from the rubber barons into the former KGB guys inside the Kremlin. So tell me about two questions. One is, have you recognized or seen this sea change in terms of growing anti-Americanism in Russia? And two, is there anything that the United States could have done given that clearly the clock is being turned back?
Well, yeah, I think first of all, we've got to be realistic about the very short period we've had, of course, of the post-Soviet period. As you say, the Berlin Wall only came down in 1989. The Soviet Union only ceased to exist in late 1991. And of course, all that we've seen since, both in terms of democratic evolutions and also moves towards or away from the market economy, from institutions of objective justice, the whole idea of property rights, all of those are terribly new. They never existed in Soviet times. They never existed in pre-Soviet Tsarist times. And I think even in the 1990s, sometimes we can get a bit romantic about how far democratic progress as well as free market progress really occurred. If you look at the existence of ordinary Russians, many of them are still probably living off in worse conditions or no better conditions than they were 15 years ago. And rightly or wrongly, many of them look at the 1990s as a period of huge disruption, a loss of status in the world, a loss of their own living standards, and they associate that with Western influence, including American consultants and political pressures and so on, which they largely see as a failure. And therefore, the irony of all this, if you like, is that Putin's anti-democratic or at least more authoritarian thrust in the last 4 years has actually been very widely supported by ordinary Russians who see his rule being associated with a resurgence of Russia's pride and influence in the world, and first and foremost with their own material well-being being reestablished again after a long period of chaos. So I think we've got to be realistic about all of those changes and their context and how weakly grounded democracy was. And even indeed, if we talk about Ukraine, to the extent to which we can really very simply draw a dividing line between the sort of the pro-Western, supposedly pro-market democratic Yushchenko and the more revanchist Soviet Eastern-looking Yanukovych, I think it's a bit more complicated than that. As to the general sentiment of anti-Americanism, I think, as I say, that's probably largely linked to those associations with the negative or at least mixed records of the 1990s. But I don't think ordinary Russians really resent ordinary Americans. They do feel a little bit that, particularly under President Bush, there's been a resurgence of unilateralism, which they resent. But on the other hand, they're pragmatic. And as long as the U.S. administration doesn't want to interfere too far in Russia's domestic politics, I think the Russians are relatively comfortable with that.
Well, I understand that jailing robber barons is actually is quite popular, and that the date that Russians most remember is not the fall of the Berlin Wall or the coup against Gorbachev and the ascension of Yeltsin. Isn't the traumatic day that they all remember is the devaluation?
That's right. I mean, a whole series of course, financial crises, and perhaps first and foremost, that whole idea of the period of privatizations in the 90s, which weren't seen as the introduction, really, of a market economy so much as a mass transfer of state assets, the oil and gas and metals sector in particular, into the hands of a very small number of tycoons who became multimillionaire or even multi-billionaires almost overnight. And so there is widespread support for what Putin's been doing in curbing the influence of some of those oligarchs. And that also goes back to the point, though, we're talking about America's influence in Russia. There was this huge debate about who lost Russia in the 1990s. I think the reality is that first and foremost, the Russians themselves have been responsible for the fate of their country, and the influence of the West really is realistically quite small.
And Andrew, I would ask you, if I can jump in here, Ian,
sure.
Is there another factor too here with Putin's rise, and that is the Chechen terrorism and the Chechen wars? It seems that Putin has often been able to increase his popularity at times when Chechen bombings, whether they be in apartment complexes in Moscow or more recently of planes and of schools, he has been able to parlay that and a sense of nationalism to his own political advantage. And at the same time, by invoking terrorism, provides himself political cover vis-a-vis the West and the U.S. He is our, quote, partner in the war on terrorism, unquote, and that has been a political winner for him and given him some insulation.
Yes, I think Putin's rise to power and his continued success has been very closely linked to Chechnya. As you say, he came to power really on the back of launching a second war in that republic. He frequently has made reference to it. He was very quick after September 11th and in Russia's terror-related tragedies connected to Chechnya to argue that this was the responsibility of international terror. And it seems that in ordinary Russian public opinion, there is widespread support for that view, not that Putin should move towards reconstruction and greater democratization, but he should take an ever tougher line in clamping down on terror. I think the unfortunate thing, of course, going forwards is that if that idea of Putin was at least publicly sold to ordinary Russians as being the way to bring about stability and to prevent the destabilization of Russia and the introduction or the intensification of links to foreign terror, the reality has been that actually we've seen the Caucasus becoming less and less stable as a result. And I think in Putin's second term, that will increasingly be a challenge, which is going to start threatening his popularity.
Well, of course, President Bush and Putin do, to some extent, see eye to eye on the war on terror, and they both may well be facing a kind of mirror image of the same problems, Putin in Chechnya and Bush in Iraq. But let me ask Dr. Jim Walsh about the notion that there are 1,600 Ukrainian troops in Iraq, and how much is that token, even though it's not very much. President Bush does often take pride in this so-called international coalition in Iraq. And it became an issue, of course, in the campaign, as you recall, with Kerry. Is there any, because we have this these few Ukrainians helping us out in Iraq, is that giving certainly the outgoing Kuchma, there's many occasions when he was tied in with all kinds of corruption, you know, selling radar to Milosevic and other things. I think also to Iraq as well. So what's your reading on whether that token, the number of troops, is buying some political breaks for Kuchma?
Well, I think you put it right, Ian. The whole issue of support from Kuchma is really cut both ways. And I think it's smart that we do focus on not just Putin, but on Kuchma. This is a person who served two terms, and part of the vote...
His handpicked successor is the guy that was fraudulently elected, right?
Exactly. And to answer your question first about the U.S. view, I think, yes, he sent, was politically wise to send troops to sort of snuggle up to President Bush. But then once we caught him exporting military-related equipment to Iraq, I think that sort of undercut whatever benefits or whatever points he had gotten in his favor. The other thing is the U.S. has been increasingly critical of Kuchma for the corruption, for the lack of transparency. Indeed, these sort of black market arms deals, I think, are a reflection of the lack of transparency and a reflection of corruption, a lack of economic reform and human rights issues. So all of those together have made Kuchma in particular and the Ukrainian government less sympathetic over time. And then finally with this election, I think we've really crossed the Rubicon and we said no more. There's a problem with the election here and we want to see Kuchma and his guard go. Now the question, I think, anytime you have a struggle for power, and hopefully what will be a peaceful struggle for power in Ukraine, is what happens to the losers? Are they taken care of? Or do they stay on in the bureaucracy? Do they become a force for mischief? That's one of the questions that's going to have to be answered, as well as the question of how do we transition from here to some other, some future point. Is it another election? Is it a coalition government? Whatever it is, there's going to have to be something that's going to be worked out, and then we'll have to figure out what's going to happen to the folks who supported Kuchma's government, because they're not going to get up and leave.
I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking with Andrew Jack, the author of Inside Putin's Russia, who is in London, and Dr. Jim Walsh, who is the international security expert at the Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. Just first to you, Andrew Jack, do you think that given the cultural and political split in the Ukraine between pro-Western and pro-Russian, the West and the Eastern part, is this standoff likely to lead to a geographic split? Or is that possible?
I suppose in theory it's possible. I doubt whether it'll happen. First of all, clearly there is a distinct difference between the west and the eastern parts of Ukraine in terms of the intensity of Russian influence, the language, the history, the very different context, with western Ukraine much longer being linked to Europe and the east much more to Russia. But that said, both Yanukovych and Yushchenko, the two presidential candidates, have spoken out against any idea of division of the country. There's no long history, certainly, of civil conflict or violence that would perhaps lead to the idea of a civil war. And I think there's also very little stomach, either in Russia and particularly in the West, for some new form of Balkanization. So I think it's a bit early, really, yet to talk about any violent separation of the two sides. And I think politically, if we're talking about a more peaceful route, there's also very little desire. Let's face it, you know, the majority of Ukrainians recognize realistically that their fate, at least for the medium term, is very much tied to Russia, whatever their personal values and historical perspectives might be. And so I think any radical change in that situation or the borders of Ukraine itself is relatively unlikely.
And Dr. Jim Walsh, what's your reading on whether or not the country could split? And obviously, at this point, the nearest way that we can see a way out of this standoff is another election. So, two questions.
Yes, well, you know, I agree with Andrew, and not only that, I hope he's right, because I think any sort of partition or federation or split, however you want to characterize it, would be bad, bad news, and it would create all sorts of opportunities for mischief. And so I hope that that doesn't happen. If the EU process continues, if in fact Ukraine at some point joins the European Union, I think it would make federation or split less likely. In the near term, I think it goes back to this question about what do you do with the folks who don't win the election, the losers. You know, and that's the great grace of democracy, is that disputes are settled in the ballot box. The losers have a chance to win later on. They don't feel like they have to take up arms or violence because they feel like they have democratic alternatives. And so if this democratic process catches hold and stabilizes, and whoever wins the election or the second election or however this is resolved finds a way to bring in or to reach out to the folks who lost the election so that they still feel like they have a stake in Ukraine as a government, as a country, then that'll be a tremendous victory and a tremendous transformation. That is the value of democracy, is that you can resolve these differences without force. So I'm hopeful, and I think Andrew is persuasive, logically, to think that we can avoid a split, because I think that would be very bad indeed.
And back to Andrew, do you get, from living in so long in Moscow, what's your sense of the people's attitude to democracy? I know it's a broad question, but you get the feeling that it's hard to believe that in countries like Belarus they could be happy with Lukashenko, this flagrant crook, and that the same is true of this fellow that's just been fraudulently elected in the Ukraine. It's as though we're talking about the lumpen proletariat, the terminally brainwashed. I mean, what's your sense of the democratic soul of Russia?
Yeah, I mean, I think even in Belarus, which you were first mentioning, there's no doubt that there were widespread abuses. But I think at least until a year or two ago, Lukashenko, the president there, while definitely a dictator, was actually genuinely popular. And I think to some degree, although in a much more enlightened form, Putin is out of that same mold. He is a strong leader, and I think Russians on the whole respect that. He's somebody who has restored a lot of pride to Russia, improved people's living standards, and is seen as, frankly, someone who looks quite impressive on the world stage after the 1990s, when President Boris Yeltsin, for all his democratic instincts, frankly, very often appeared to be something between a national joke and a national tragedy, you know, appearing drunk, not even appearing, collapsing, mixing up his words. And this was a source of shame for ordinary Russians. So, you know, though in the West we would very often cast this as sort of Putin being anti-democratic and Yeltsin being democratic, Russians, I think, see it in another way. It's not simply a question of being brainwashed or lumpen proletariat, but simply they see Putin as reestablishing order and control and effectiveness and improving their ordinary living standards. So there is a sort of, you know, populist, semi-democratic element to Putin's wave of support, although the way we would assess it in the West with media diversity and counterbalancing powers, institutions and so on that check the excessive influence of the president, they certainly have not been the characteristic of the last few years.
So do you think, for example, I mean, what is the Russian press, how are they treating the Ukrainian crisis? Are they talking about Western meddling and the encroachment, the eastward encroachment of NATO?
Yeah, the Russian press has been pretty mixed, and despite the fact that national television in particular has come much more tightly under the Kremlin's control in the past 4 years, the print media and some of the radio and internet sources available are much more diverse and critical. So the print media, the national dailies and so on, for example, have been split down the middle. Some have talked about rather heavy-handed and clumsy tactics by the Kremlin in Ukraine and other recent elections in the region as being a serious mistake. But there's no doubt, and with some degree of reason, that more officially orientated media have talked about Western as well as Russian influence in the outcome of elections in Ukraine, and argued, for example, that some of the election abuses that took place in Ukraine were also seen but much less criticized in Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, and some of these other regions which are seen as strategic powers and where the West has wanted to push in a particular direction.
A quick last word from Dr. Walsh. We're just going live to Baghdad here in a moment. So just your closing thoughts here, Dr. Walsh, in terms of whether this crisis can be resolved, whether it will result in a new election or it could spin out of control, which is, I think is clearly a possibility.
Well, that's always a possibility, but I must say I'm struck mostly by how well things have gone. I mean, it's always impressive, whether it was the Philippines after Marcos or whether it's the Ukraine today, when ordinary people in peaceful demonstration and protest try to take back their government and their elections. I think that's something that should give us all hope for the future. And the fact that the Supreme Court, the parliament, and most importantly, the military and internal security forces have restrained themselves and have said that they will not resort to violence, I think this is very impressive. And it's something we should all watch, and it's something to admire, and I'm hopeful that there can be a negotiated solution here. Now, you know, this cannot drag on forever. Certainly the economy can't have it drag on forever, but I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get through this period, and it'll be to Ukraine's great achievement that they've been able to pull this off.
I thank both of you for joining us. Andrew Jack in London, the author of Inside Putin's Russia, the outgoing bureau chief for the Financial Times of London in Moscow, and Dr. Jim Walsh, international security expert at the Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you. I'm now speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's calling in from Baghdad. He is the author of The World's Most Dangerous Places and Three Worlds Gone Mad. Both of these books are bestsellers. And as it happens, you are in the world's most dangerous place, aren't you? The so-called BIAP run, the Baghdad International Airport, the seven mile run into the green zone of Baghdad is for all intents and purposes one of the most dangerous places in the world, is it not?
I think so. I think it's been designated that because it is a focal point for the insurgents to prove that things are not settled here yet.
And you've done a few runs with the Blackwater security people. First of all, describe how you're protected, given that just today, I believe, a roadside bomb went off on the airport road, badly injuring two United States Army soldiers.
Well, it's an interesting run because the Baghdad airport is a very modern complex, quite large, although it's very empty. And there's basically two flights a day, and of course the insurgents know exactly when they land. And this morning, about 23 security details head out at very high speeds in some armored vehicles, bristling with guns, and they drive as fast as they can. But the odd thing is that the B operator, what they call Route Irish, has been a hot spot for a very long time. And one of the problems is that the insurgents know exactly when you're going to be on the road, and there's plenty of traffic, and you'll be driving down the road, you'll see people stopping, fixing their cars driving down the wrong way, and almost every day this week we've had a detonation, some kind of bomb, and we've had some close calls within about 2-3 minutes, and it's just a matter of luck sometimes.
But you obviously have cell phone blockers that send out an electronic envelope that prevent these improvised explosive devices from going off. So they must have figured another way to set them off. So I've seen footage of these things going off. They're substantial bombs. So
well, that's actually old school, and those are the old days. What they're doing now, they're suicide bombers. They take vehicles like Honda Civics or minivans or pickup trucks. They load them with about 300 pounds of explosives, which is a massive amount of explosives, and they designate a driver, and they have a watch out. And as soon as they see a convoy coming along, they get into the flow of traffic. What they used to do is they used to speed up very quickly behind the convoy, pull alongside and detonate. Now what they do is they pull up the front and they slow down and they detonate. And the vehicles we're driving in are armored vehicles called Mambas, which are this sort of old South African type vehicles built on a Univog chassis. And in each vehicle, we have three of these. They have heavy weaponry. We have a BKM machine gun on the front and at least two other gunners with M4s on the side, and we actually, when we drive down the road, they fire at vehicles and get too close or act erratically. It's a very, very tense situation.
And the suicide cars, are these the ones that are, I read the other day that one of the ways you know a suicide car in Iraq is if a bearded guy that looks like a Wahhabi is driving. Is it quite...
There's no way to tell, but typically you look for the way the person looks and acts and reacts. Typically anybody who jets forward into something unusual is an indicator, but sometimes they're just taxis parked with no driver at the side of the street. Sometimes they're people dressed in black. There's all sorts of theories on who is a suicide bomber, who isn't. In many cases, they're convoys of armed men that pull up alongside a machine gun into the vehicle. There's no real pattern yet.
And in terms of what you're carrying, I mean, this is obviously an important link between the airport and the green zone. Are you carrying personnel or equipment is this the route that VIPs take when they come? Because everybody comes into the airport, don't they?
Yes, it's very mundane. I mean, that is what's so strategic about this airport. It's where people come, whether they're contractors or people who come to help with the reconstruction. They land in the airport and they have to obviously get into town, whether it's the green zone or what they call it the international zone now, because it's not really green, as in safe. And by disrupting that flow and terrorizing people, they're proving that this country is not ready yet for reconstruction.
And in terms of the Blackwater security guys that you're with, they from the pictures you sent me, they all look like they're former special forces. Is that true?
No, there's some of them. There's a cop from Los Angeles. There are Marines. There are people from various military backgrounds. Some are Army. They're not elite soldiers, but every day they strap on their gear and make that run, and they're very cheerful about it. And even though these convoys are hit quite regularly, this particular convoy has been operating for 2.5 months and hasn't been hit. And I think a lot of it has to do with the extremely aggressive stance they take when they go on the road.
And are they doing jobs that the military doesn't want to do?
Well, there are military convoys. I mean, when, for example, large groups of contractors have to get to and from the airport, they are sort of disregarded by Humvees with 50 calibers, and they have armored buses. Those are the armored buses that were hit, I think, yesterday. Typically, the target here is the military convoys, but there are, like I said, at least 20 to 30 sort of high-speed GMC convoys of businessmen, could be journalists, could be anybody. They tend to focus more on the military because that's more of a symbolic act.
Mm-hmm. And when you get to the Green Zone itself, I mean, where is it in Iraq or in Baghdad that where you can feel safe? If it seems that the road itself has got to be incredibly hair-raising, the airport's obviously...
Well, if you look at it, yeah, that particular road obviously is the most dangerous place here, but if you look at a map of Iraq with all the various incidents overlaid on an acetate sheet, it sort of looks like it has a measles, because there are little spots everywhere for shootings, RPGs, bombs. When you talk to locals here about what it's like in the neighborhoods at night, there's typically quite a bit of chaos. It's obviously not a safe place, and they've pushed a lot of the insurgents out of Fallujah, and that has pushed them, of course, into Baghdad and other regions.
So do you get the impression that the situation in terms of mobility, access to the country, supply routes, logistics, is it getting better or worse? I mean,
well, everyone I've talked to here that's worked here for any period of time says that the situation is much worse here. The number of attacks on vehicles or Westerners working here is higher. There are untold numbers of kidnappings and murders and attacks that aren't reported in the media because the media is essentially confined to their hotels, and they go out, of course, with security details. But right now, I don't think anybody's got a good handle on this area. I mean, the north is fine, and the south is not as dangerous. But this particular area, which is mistakenly called the Sunni Triangle, but it's basically the heartland of Iraq, is very dangerous.
And in terms of supplying the 140,000 U.S. soldiers, not to mention the civilian contractors, etc., most supplies have to be brought in by road, right, from Kuwait or from Jordan?
Correct. Most of the supplies have to come directly from Kuwait in large convoys that are protected by security details, and they're also targets of insurgents and criminal elements. The situation hasn't really changed here much since the war. There's really only one flight in it. I mean, Royal Jordanian flies in twice a day if you want to spend $1,000 to get here by that flight.
Mm.
But it hasn't changed much.
And what's the rest of the traffic coming into Baghdad International?
There are a lot of Iraqis coming here. There's a lot of people trying to make money on the reconstruction funds that are coming in here. But there isn't that much traffic. I mean, Baghdad International is a huge airport, and it's kind of a ghost town.
So, obviously the guys that you're with, the Blackwater people, they're being pretty well paid, aren't they?
So the average rate here is between $400 and $600 a day,
right.
And they're worth every penny of it because they face violence almost every single day, and they're also very professional in what they do. So, I don't think I'd do that for a living.
So, have you had any opportunities to talk to the regular military people to get a perspective from them, given that you're embedded with the contractors?
Well, I'm not really embedded. I'm just hanging out. But I actually pity the regular military because they have to sit at these checkpoints and do the patrol at night, and they have no idea what could happen next. But they're doing their job cheerfully, and they grin and bear it.
Uh-huh. So it's really a case of kind of, gallows humor, but no end in sight. I'm just trying to get an impression from you whether there's a feeling that this mission has a purpose, has an end game? I mean, here we are over here in the United States, apparently in some kind of blissful cocoon of ignorance, talking about elections and in January and all this stuff, and you're describing a place that's worse than Fort Apache.
Well, it's much more violent than it was after the war. The you know, the cliche is light at the end of the tunnel, but there's really no tunnel because there is no end that anybody has here in sight for us of a democratic, peaceful Iraq. But I think the only positive development here is I think the very violent attacks in Fallujah has destabilized and worn down some of the insurgent elements. But there are, you know, there's over 30 groups fighting in Iraq. It's not, once we get rid of one area, there's still plenty of other areas. So I don't see any short-term solution, and I definitely don't see any positive environment for reconstruction here.
And everybody that you that's out there on the road, that you're saying you have to machine gun cars if they even start to look suspicious. So is there a sense of from the point of view of the military and from the point of view of the security people, who the enemy is? I mean, is it the Iraqi people,
no.
or is it? I mean, it seems to me that it's hard to distinguish between Iraqi citizens and insurgents.
Right. Well, they're one and the same. I mean, there's a large group of disaffected people here who have no income, and there are large groups of criminal elements, and there are large groups of people who essentially want to push back against the American occupation. It would be very difficult to put your finger on a nice, clear structure as to who's fighting back. But, you know, as best as I can understand it, there are a lot of people getting paid to cause, you know, mayhem and to attack American forces. I would not say as a whole that the Iraqi people are opposed to the idea of peace and stability here. Obviously, when you drive down the road, most of the people are just going about their daily business. They're not angry. But just when you look at the faces when you drive down the street, you know, you'd be waving at one guy, and another guy would be making sort of a bomb explosion with his hand. So it's a mixed bag over here.
But how does this translate into? Of course, people want peace and security, but how does this translate into how to bring this about? I mean, if the security situation appears to be deteriorating, what is a realistic end game here?
Well, I think what you're seeing is America's need to push this election to create a sense of, forward movement. But just, all of the election people are going to have security guards. I mean, it's much more violent than in Afghanistan. And the Sunnis know that they're going to be marginalized by any democratic form of vote. So the Shias are pushing for the election, and of course the Kurds. But the Sunnis realize that as soon as they have an elected government, or at least a mandate for elected government, they will be minimized in the overall mix here. And that's one of the reasons why there is so much resistance.
And that's why there many Sunnis and some Kurds have called for a delay of the vote. But you're
I have to support that idea because this country is not really cohesive enough to have a normal electoral process.
Hmm. Well, given that what you're telling me, is this analysis shared widely by the press? Even though you say the press are hunkered down and in the hotels inside the Green Zone, and it's dangerous for them to go out, I'm just trying to get to balance what you're telling me with this general impression that we get from Washington, and is that everything's going according to plan and.
Well, I would invite any person that shares the opinion that you just stated to come on over and drive from the airport without an armored car and without an escort and to walk around the city at night and see if he still shares that idea.
Well, in that context, Robert Young-Pelton, I hope you keep your head down and stay safe, even though you're clearly putting yourself in harm's way there.
That's the only way to find out what's really going on here.
Well, again, I wish you all the best and stay safe. And thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. Hello, again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Robert Young-Pelton, the author of Three Worlds Gone Mad and The World's Most Dangerous Places, these both bestsellers, and he is, as we speak, in The World's Most Dangerous Place, traveling with convoys from the Baghdad International Airport into the green zone of Baghdad. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, Mark Maxwell, the engineer. This program and previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.